William Randolph Hearst is mostly associated with yellow journalism and Citizen Kane. In a new biography, The Uncrowned King, The Sensational Rise of William Randolph Hearst, Kenneth White argues that the popular image of Hearst is false and reintroduces us to a committed, idealistic, and tenacious young journalist. Mr. White is currently the publisher and editor-in-chief of Maclean's, the leading weekly current affairs magazine in Canada. His book is published by Counterpoint, and it brings Mr. White to the show today. Welcome.
Nice to be here.
How much of the popular image of William Randolph Hearst has been shaped by Citizen Kane and what I was taught in high school history classes about his role in fomenting the Spanish-American War?
Well, probably the second or third question, if not the first question, everywhere I go to talk about Hearst is about Citizen Kane, so it's obviously shaped a huge part of William Randolph Hearst's presence in American culture. Orson Welles, who made the movie, said about 10 years after it was made that it really didn't bear much resemblance to Hearst's life, and Peter Bogdanovich, who interviewed Welles a lot, in the end concluded it actually resembled Welles' life a lot more than Hearst's life in terms of a guy who started off as a boy wonder and ended up sort of disappointed and broken. So I think the image we have of him is quite far off base.
But you've decided to do a revisionist examination of Hearst, but focusing on the early years, because he did change in the later years. In fact, we have a clip of a speech that he made, I think it is from 1939, this is the William Randolph Hearst that I remember from reading the Journal American years later.
The facts are that there are no hostile nations at present attempting to attack the United States. There are no nations at present even thinking of attacking the United States. There are no nations that are able to attack the United States. There are no nations that have any reason to attack the United States unless we offer them reason by our dull interference in foreign affairs or our unwarranted intrusion into alien situations which in no way properly concern our free republic.
Now, that was William Randolph Hearst, the isolationist, in that speech as well. He defends the Japanese invasion of China as an anti-imperialist action.
Well, Hearst's views about America's involvement in European affairs didn't really change over the years. And back in the period I'm writing about, when he was a young man in New York in the 1890s, he was not an imperialist at that time and believed that America's proper sphere of influence was in the Western Hemisphere, in the Caribbean, and in North America. And that was his interest in Cuba at the time. And he is accused of fomenting the Spanish-American War.
Which many people see as an imperialist war.
Yes, they did see it that way. And he's seen as having done so for no greater reason than a desire to sell newspapers. I look back from the very start of his concern with Cuba in New York in 1895, and from the very start he had a very principled interest in the Cuban rebellion against Spanish dominion. He thought that Spain was squeezing Cuba in order to improve its finances in the mother country, and that the Cuban people were right to rebel for all the same reasons that America was right to rebel against Great Britain a century before. And so he had that very principled support from the outset with the Cuban rebellion. And then when Spain began to put down the rebellion with harsher and harsher measures, including the use of reconcentration camps, in which first tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands of people were rounded up and left to starve and die of diseases in these camps, he was outraged by it, and he demanded American intervention and on humanitarian grounds. And if you look at McKinley's war message to Congress, he articulates almost identical arguments for intervening against Spain that Hearst had been calling for 3 years.
Perhaps the problem is that famous telegram exchange with Frederick Remington, which sounds a lot more cynical. Remington writes, "Everything is quiet. There's no trouble here. There'll be no war. I wish to return." And Hearst replies, "Please remain. You furnish the pictures, and I'll furnish the war."
Yes, and that telegram has never been found and exists only in transcript in a book by James Creelman, in which he was arguing for the almighty power of yellow journalism at the time and got a lot of his facts wrong in the presentation.
So you're saying
and,
this is apocryphal?
Yeah, I don't think we have any reason to believe that if Hearst did write a similar message to that, that he meant what Creelman thinks he meant in that. If you look at the circumstances at the time that message was supposedly sent, Cleveland was in power, and Cleveland said he was not going to intervene. McKinley was the president-elect. He was against the intervention at the time, and the last person he was going to listen to was William Randolph Hearst, because Hearst had spent the last campaign hammering at the good reputation of William McKinley. So it's just inconceivable that Hearst would have thought that he could drum up a war and that if his artists stayed on in Cuba for a few more weeks, they'd have the troops there.
He had actually backed William Jennings Bryan.
Yes, he did. And
which comes as a surprise to all people who think of William Randolph Hearst as a hidebound conservative.
William Randolph Hearst was a radical progressive in New York. And
in the early years, he did change.
The world changed more, I think, than he changed. And what had been radically progressive in the 1890s was, by the time of the New Deal, a bit reactionary. His politics didn't really move with the time. But back in the 1890s, he had all the radically progressive writers in his stable, and he himself was very much a man of the people and genuinely, deeply concerned for the welfare of the common man.
What led you to decide that he deserved a revisionist examination?
I didn't start out wanting to write any sort of revisionism about Hearst. I was writing about a newspaper war. To me, this battle between Hearst and Pulitzer in New York in the 1890s was the most exciting period in the history of print media in North America, and I wanted to write about it. You get bits of it in the biographies of Hearst and Pulitzer, but nobody ever went really deep on it. So I was writing about that, and it was only as I began to look at his newspaper and what they actually produced and compare it to other newspapers and what they produced and got deeper into his correspondence and what he was trying to achieve, I got a very, very different picture of Hearst.
Well, I want to get to that newspaper war in a little while, but maybe we can go back a bit. How did William Randolph Hearst break into the newspaper business in the first place? If Citizen Kane is to be trusted and your book, his father was in the mining business and had no interest in newspapers.
Well, he was in the mining business, but very interested in newspapers and very interested in politics. And at the time, being interested in politics meant you were interested in newspapers.
Because newspapers had a lot more clout in those days.
They did, and they were all politically charged in one way or the other. So he had political ambitions, George Hearst, W.R.'s father, and he wanted to be a power in the Democratic Party in San Francisco, and he bought a newspaper to that end. He did nothing but lose money on this paper, the San Francisco Examiner, and eventually when his son leaves Harvard under a bit of a cloud, they give him the San Francisco Examiner, and he makes a really going concern of it, turns it around, makes it profitable, and a real force in San Francisco life.
And what was it like in those days? The whole idea of being objective did not occur to journalists.
To nobody. And you see it when Hearst comes to New York in 1895. There's 48 daily newspapers in the city.
48?
17 in the evening and the rest in the morning. If you didn't have a strong point of view and ability to be heard above the crowd, you didn't last. You didn't survive. So everybody was politically motivated, politically charged, aligned with one candidate or party at all times.
Now, why did he even come to New York? He had a success in San Francisco, which is a nice town. Many New Yorkers want to move to San Francisco.
Because then, as now, if you make it in New York, you're top of the heap. It was the center of excellence in journalism in America.
So he bought a newspaper here?
Yes, and he also, at that point, had a vision for a national chain of newspapers and knew that he couldn't do it without New York, because New York was the media capital of the country. So in order for him to build a media empire, which was his goal from a very early age, he knew he had to conquer New York. So he comes here in 1895. He buys a small paper. It's down on its luck, losing money, has about 50,000 circulation, and immediately engages Joseph Pulitzer, who's the king of the heap, a towering figure in the American press at the time. In fact, literally a towering figure. He had the biggest building in New York, the biggest commercial building in the world. It was a monument to his success as a publisher. And Hearst engaged him in a war for a newspaper circulation supremacy in New York, and they went head-to-head for 3 years.
So by going after Pulitzer, he made himself an equal, even though he really wasn't an equal. But he must have done other things. What we associate with that newspaper war is the phrase yellow journalism, which grew out of a cartoon that used color and had to have been the most racist cartoon ever published in America, or at least in a major newspaper.
I don't think it was racist at all, actually.
Well, the yellow kid was a Chinese kid who, you don't
had,
think there was any racism?
He had vaguely oriental features, but these were street urchins, and they were all, most of them Irish represented in there, and I don't think that the yellow kid himself really had any determinate racial features. And he was actually, it was the opposite of racist. He and his fellow characters were, I think, given a lot of credit. They were smart. They were sort of uppity, and they were mocking all the time the better classes in New York and their activities. So the cartoon was very much on the side of these kids.
So there was a kind of a populist appeal.
Absolutely.
And advertising revenues were not as important as circulation revenues?
No, at the time, you got your money by attracting readers, and you also got some advertising revenue, but that just followed the readers. So everything was about finding audiences, building and attracting audiences, and Hearst was, like Pulitzer, a master at it. And you had to have great contents to attract readers, because readers were very savvy at that time, much more so in our days, because they had so many choices, and you could find a newspaper catering to every taste and political
persuasion. Well, how did he go after Pulitzer?
Well, he hired the best editors and the best talent in town, and they produced the best stories, the most enterprising journalism, the most exciting columnists, the most trenchant political commentary, and the most exciting features. And it was a really strong newspaper in all dimensions. It had a real heart, it had real intelligence, and it was just a riveting read. And because readers were savvy and they moved from paper to paper at that time, if you had a good product, you attracted readers very quickly. And so he went from having 50,000 circulation to having about 125,000 circulation in a matter of weeks. And after the 1896 election, when he was all alone as the champion of William Jennings Bryan and the common man in the whole of the Northeast, he was up over 250,000-300,000 neck and neck with Pulitzer, and soon he passed him.
What I remember from my history classes, again, was that he did it by luring readers with sensationalized stories of sex and violence and stories that weren't always as accurate as one would have liked.
That was always the criticism of the elite papers who couldn't compete with him journalistically.
Well, the same sort of thing that we hear now about Rupert Murdoch and in his wars with Mortimer Zuckerman at the Daily News.
To an extent, yes. I think one way that you can draw a comparison between Hearst and Murdoch is both of them do have a populist, popular touch, and they find areas of media that are relatively underserviced and provide content that people genuinely want. And they're dealing with mass audiences brilliantly, dealing with mass audiences, and they have a lot of elite critics, and they're similar in that respect. I don't know that Murdoch was as genuinely concerned for a set of ideas as Hearst tends to be, or Hearst was.
My guest is Kenneth White, W-H-Y-T-E. His book, The Uncrowned King, The Sensational Rise of William Randolph Hearst. It is published by Counterpoint. Well, what did political commitment mean in those days? Did it mean running editorials, or was it? Would it have been reflected in the news columns as well?
It was all-out political commitment. It was you championed a party, you championed its ideas, and you not only upheld your party, you attacked the other guy in the fiercest way possible. And it wasn't just Hertz paper did that. All papers did that. That was how they operated. And to not do that, they considered you a eunuch and you weren't part of the conversation. So in the 1896 election, Hearst not only takes on Bryan and his cause, which was at the time the Free Silver Movement.
A losing cause,
yes, but a very close election, fortunately, for Hearst. By mercilessly attacking William McKinley and his campaign manager Mark Hanna on often very solid grounds, raising real issues about the use of money in McKinley's campaign, McKinley's relations to corporate America, and the money that McKinley got from people like Mark Hanna, bailed him out personally over the years, and whether or not McKinley was beholden to these rich guys who bailed him out personally, asking really good, hard questions. But that was how you did it at the time, and Hearst did it as well as anyone.
And Hearst was very much a supporter of antitrust laws. So when Teddy Roosevelt became president after McKinley died, did he switch allegiance?
Did Hearst switch allegiance?
Yeah. Hearst, to the Republican?
No, Hearst supported a lot of the trust-busting measures that Roosevelt pursued. And there were issues on which they were aligned. But Hearst was never really a big fan of Roosevelt, except during the Spanish-American War. He considered what Roosevelt to have done then to be heroic. And that was, I think, one of the few times that Roosevelt got good press in a Hearst paper.
Well, Hearst has been criticized for his paper's coverage of the sinking of the Maine. Mm-hmm. Does your research put him in a better light?
Well, no, I think actually there's a few weeks right after the Maine sunk, in the whole 3 years of coverage that Hearst did of the Spanish-American War, probably did his worst week in that period after the Maine sunk. He was so fed up by that point with Spain's treatment of the Cuban people and what he saw and what a lot of observers saw was an effort to exterminate the civilian population in Cuba. His paper kind of lost it, and it was very noisy, and it was self-promoting, and it did make some real mistakes in that time, and he deserves to be criticized for that. But when I think, when you look at the sweep of his work on that story, he did some tremendous work. I just want to say one other note about the sensationalism and the yellow journalism accusations. Those were slurs by elite papers with small audiences. At the time, yes, it was the New York Times, which took a very condescending view to the rabble, the mob, and didn't believe that a paper like Hearst should champion the sentiments of the common people and its politics and its issues, and they thought that was bottom-dwelling and that newspapers should do better than that. But Hearst was very democratic in spirit and tone, and yellow journalism as a concept has never really been anything but a slur.
What was happening at the San Francisco Chronicle at the time, and how did Hearst come to build a chain of 30 newspapers?
Well, he managed to keep his paper was the Examiner, the Chronicle was his competitor. He managed to keep it going while still fighting the war in New York, and then once he triumphed in this city, he began acquiring other newspapers in Boston, Chicago, and kept adding them on. I think his newspapers over time declined in quality because he no longer had the ability to be a hands-on editor. And he was a brilliant editor himself. But the further he got away from his products, the weaker he got. And some of the criticism in his later years is justified.
I started doing the show many years ago with a woman named Pegeen Fitzgerald who had worked for Hearst. And she told me that one of his approaches to personnel was, If an editor or a reporter had displeased him, he'd be moved away from the center of the newsroom And if you found yourself on the loading dock, you knew that you were about to be fired.
That's funny, because I was at San Simeon Castle doing a presentation last week, and they said the same thing about his dining room table at San Simeon, that a guest would be seated next to him at the start of the week, and if he was poor conversation, he'd get pushed further and further down the table till he was pretty much out the door.
So what led him to leave New York City and build his castle outside of San Luis Obispo?
He was always a Californian at heart and a Westerner at heart, and he liked New York well enough. He liked Broadway, he liked the showgirls, he had and liked to have fun in town. But he came here on business. He came here to conquer the New York publishing world. And once he'd done that and set up his chain, he was always going to go home, I think.
Was he also somebody who was technologically savvy?
Yeah, he had, this was a time of real ferment in newspapers, and presses were getting infinitely more complex and powerful, and they could run off, a million and a half copies in a day, and he had the most advanced printing technology around, and they were using new technology like the newfangled telephone and the telegraph and steamcraft, and it was a very expansive, exciting time to be in the newspaper business. Not a lot a lot different than today.
And even later, when the Journal American folded, along with a lot of other newspapers here in New York, the New York Post moved into the old Journal American building because it had better printing plant.
Yeah. Well, Hearst really believed that quality mattered in newspapers, and that not only did you have to have the best talent, but you had to have the best color, the sharpest looking paper, the best art design, so on.
When we look at the handling of the Spanish Civil War and what Hearst did, you're a Canadian, so you could give us an outsider's view. How do you assess the American press's handling of the 9/11 story and the subsequent lead up to the war in Iraq?
There's some funny parallels between the Spanish-American War and what happened after 9/11, because I think America did a great thing in Cuba in intervening in Cuba, and what Spain was doing in Cuba was really despicable, and it was a great thing to step in. Intervene there. But there were unintended consequences to that. Suddenly the U.S. finds itself in possession of the Philippines and it can't decide whether or not to grant them independence, ends up staying and fighting a war in the Philippines that was very costly in lives and treasure. Bogged American down for a long, long time. You look at the war on terror, I think what the U.S. did in Afghanistan was very laudable. Canada is still there right now fighting, and I hope we stay, and I hope that America ramps up its presence there.
But what about the role of
then
the newspapers?
Going into Iraq was sort of an unintended consequence that had very dire consequences.
I was thinking about the role of newspapers because many people have looked at some of the reporting that mm-hmm. came out, and even today, we didn't always get the best reporting. And it was to some degree, I guess, whenever there's a conflict, there's a certain amount of jingoism in the press. And Hearst probably didn't invent that either.
No, I don't think, that Hearst was a jingo. He didn't want war for war's sake. There were people who did at the time, most notably Teddy Roosevelt. But Hearst, for him, it was entirely a humanitarian cause in Cuba. And he was very clear about that I think sincere about it. And look, the press at the time did make mistakes. They were wrong about the sinking of the Maine. They thought that it had been blown up by an outside force, and it probably just blew itself up. And so we were wrong about weapons of mass destruction. We're often wrong. It's a fallible medium.
Kenneth White is the publisher and editor-in-chief of Maclean's, Canada's weekly current affairs magazine. His book, The Uncrowned King, The Sensational Rise of William Randolph Hearst, is published by Counterpoint. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks. Nice to be here.